everyone. It's Janice, host of the Divorcing Religion podcast. Thanks for tuning into my show, whether you're joining me on audio or video. I've heard from some folks recently who have told me just how much the show has meant, and some of them have even found it not only to be life-changing, but life-saving, as they felt there was no one else who understood what they were going through, and they found the Divorcing Religion podcast, and they started feeling encouraged. Please help me keep my show on the air. Become a member by clicking the join button on the Conference on Religious Trauma YouTube channel. Thanks. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Divorcing Religion podcast. I'm your host, Janice Selby. I'm a registered professional counselor and a religious recovery consultant. And I am excited to share two guests with you today. I had the privilege and honor of meeting them both in December of 2023 when I attended their conference at Syracuse University in New York. And the conference was The Religious Origins of White Supremacy. So it was just a phenomenal event. It was very interesting for me. And so I'll start with introducing Sandy Bigtree. Sandy is a citizen of the Mohawk Nation at Akwesasne and was a founding board member of the American Indian Law Alliance. She's a founding board member of the Indigenous Values Initiative, which fosters collaborative educational work between the academic community and the Haudenosaunee to promote the message of peace that was brought to Onondaga Lake thousands of years ago. Oh, yes. Okay, very good. It is this message that continues to influence American democracy, the women's rights movement, and the environmental justice movement. She was an original planning committee member of SCANOM, the Great Law of Peace Center, and currently sits on the Educational Collaborative Committee. And Dr. Philip Arnold, president of the Indigenous Values Initiative, associate professor Religion, Syracuse University, and founding director, SCANOM Great Law of Peace Center. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's just a delight to see you again.
Thank you. Great to be with you, Janice.
Thanks so much for having us, Janice. This is
great. Your work I can hardly is believe
really
it.
Interesting.
Yes. Thank you. Mm-hmm. There's been so much trauma that has devastated so many people in the name of religion. And I feel none to a greater degree than Indigenous peoples around the world. And of course, I'm in Canada. We have our First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people. And you're joining me from what's now known as the United States, where people have also suffered terribly in the name of religion, particularly Christianity. And so I wondered if we might start with you providing a little bit of education around the religious origins of white supremacy, the doctrine of discovery. I mean, it's going to have to be kind of the Reader's Digest condensed version, but I think my listeners and viewers would be very interested to know about the doctrine of discovery.
Yeah, so it's a very... As you said, it's a very big issue, a very big phenomenon, we'll say, but it's also quite specific, right? So we could talk about specific 15th century, that is, papal bulls that came out in the 1400s, mid-1400s, and then, of course, after Columbus's voyages to what was then, seen as India or the New World. And these papal bulls that were issued from the Vatican essentially give monarchs the permission, indeed kind of the requirement, that when they enter the lands of non-Christian peoples, those lands are automatically deeded to the Christian nations and to the Vatican. The bodies of those people are to be subjugated to the church and to Spain, Portugal, etc. And all their earthly possessions are to be confiscated for the purposes of extending the Christian empire, or Christendom, as they called it then. Right? So these papal documents all through the 15th century, of course, have precedence in the Crusades and earlier times, right? The 11th century and earlier. So it's kind of on a continuum in terms of European history. But for indigenous peoples around the world, first in West Africa and, you know, throughout that region, this is the origin of transatlantic slavery, for example. To enslave people was part of these doctrines. And then later on, of course, into the Americas. So anytime Christians entered the lands of non-Christian people, they were regarded as pagans, Saracens, enemies of Christ that had to be subjugated. Their bodies were put into the service of Christendom. So it's very specific in some ways. In a way, we can understand sort of the hubris of Christianity at the time. But then fast forward into the 1823, and these doctrines of discovery were brought into U.S. property law through the Johnson v. McIntosh decision in the U.S. Supreme Court. And it's part of a trilogy of decisions that had really global impact. So the idea that Christian and civilizing nations then take over the role of the monarch or the sponsoring king of the 15th century is now in the 19th century. And so now it's fundamental to U.S. and really global property law and international laws having to do with the doctrine of discovery. So, I mean, in a nutshell, it has its origins in religion, but it has infused itself into legal and environmental issues around the world. So multinational, international corporations are utilizing these laws to gain access currently. And then it's still being propped up by the U.S. Supreme Court as recently as 2005, 2011. These become citations in U.S. Supreme Court rulings. So our thinking is to shine a light on the religious origins of the doctrine of discovery, and that might help clarify sort of the religious origins of what we're calling white supremacy. Is really, you know, like Western superiority, you know, the superiority of Europeans over the rest of the world, these kinds of, you know, cultural manifestations are what we're trying to bring out of this work.
We were in Europe last spring, and we went to the National Archives in London because we wanted to see the Cabot Charter, see the copy of that. And we actually had one original copy in a scroll that we opened. And
from 1496.
Oh, my gosh.
Right.
It gives the British king title over all of North America.
But what was interesting is that we're translating kind of the language, we found the same wording that was in those Catholic papal bulls were transcribed into British law, right? So that was kind of the middle step before they came to the Americas. Of course, North America, the British had come in here. That's why we're speaking English. But yeah, it's chilling. You can see the thread right through from the Vatican during these papal bulls of discovery. And it's a structure. It's a hierarchical structure of patriarchy, pretty much, that just goes in and attacks the core of indigenous cultures, which were usually matrilineal.
Yes.
I mean, you read the basic texts in Europe when the Jesuits came here into the Northwest Woodland Territories, and the abuse and how they just targeted the women because they were the core of this matrilineal structure that connects everyone in proper relationship to the natural world. And the Jesuits recorded in their relations that these women were the firebrands of hell. Mm-hmm. It's like, and there's what, 7,000 pages or something to read.
Yeah.
from these documents that were published in Europe for the public to read back then. It's
It's a very expansive topic, like we're indicating. It has affected Maori people or African people or, you know, Asian people, all these indigenous people that were on the ground. But it's also very specific in a way, and it's quite so various groups of people can enter into the topic from different points of view. And even, you know, Christian peoples, for example. I mean, we're working with a number of Christian denominations who have repudiated the doctrine of discovery, and over 350 of those. And in our podcast, Mapping the Doctrine of Discovery, we're trying to sort of give a sense of the various ways it impacts our world today. I mean, if you look at the news, if you look what's happening on the ground in the United States today, you know, you'll see that religious, Christian nationalism, white Christian nationalism is really rearing itself as it did almost 100 years ago in Europe. So I think it comes, you have these cycles of it reappearing in a kind of grand scale. What you're dealing with, of course, are the personal and really traumatic dimensions that we all have to grapple with in our various ways. But to look at the big picture, I think, can help our students, like, you know, put it in a kind of proper framework so they don't have to feel that it's like just happening to them. You know, it's part of a, as Sandy says, a global system, you know.
And worldview, frankly. Mm-hmm. It's the way we perceive ourselves, the way we perceive each other. And I talk about the Jesuits coming into these nations and attacking the women. And even in the accounts, these ancient accounts, which scholars don't even address, the point that even in these records, the native people already have Christian names. And right at first contact, they rename everything into some kind of a Christian context or binary, you know, of good and evil, male, female. There's just no in between. So it kind of starts there with the church. And that sets up an opposition of survival rather than having a relationship that's more expansive.
Right. Where's the room for collaboration?
Yeah.
It's just that the conquerors come in and we're going to conquer and you are going to obey or die.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow. It's breathtaking.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that's, it's kind of ancient history, but then it's kind of not. It's right here with us today. And I think, you know, from the point of view of my discipline, the academic study of religion, I feel like this is a contribution that we need to make, and, you know, from our disciplinary knowledge, you know, is more kind of an engaged way of looking at the world.
We'll be right back.
Are you tired of toxic people on the internet?
Yes.
I'm Reagan.
And I'm Chesno.
And we are the hosts of the Mr. Pick Me and the Man Hater podcast. These nicknames were lovingly given to us by a troll on the internet, even though I don't hate men, and Chesco's already been picked.
Together, we discuss some of the absolutely worst people on the internet and laugh along the way and try not to cry.
So if you want to laugh with us
or cry,
then check out the Mr. Pick Me and Man Hater podcast. Bye.
Bye.
It sure does put things into better context. It's almost like things have been out of focus, and the work that you're doing helps to put things in a better focus. I really had no idea about, I'd heard of the doctrine of discovery, but I didn't know very much about it. I didn't know anything about the Haudenosaunee. And so I wonder, Sandy, if you would talk a little bit about that. I know in the introduction I mentioned The contribution to American democracy, the women's rights movement, environmental justice movement. I didn't even know about the Confederacy. So would you tell us, do that in a nutshell somehow, to give us an overview of that?
Well, our Tadadao here, Sid Hill, he's like the spiritual center of the Haudenosaunee, kind of what the model of a president was modeled after. The United States was modeled around the structure of the Haudenosaunee. And this is a long, long story to try to encapsulate in a few moments. But in effect, when Europeans came to this country, they experienced equity, freedom, and peace among all the indigenous territories in the Americas. And right from the beginning, Columbus like took dozens of people. He enslaved several indigenous people, and they were like left in Europe, those that survived anyway. And they had great influence in the way people would be thinking in Europe, because no one was talking about equity over there. And we had speakers from like the Northeast woodlands and your Canada, right? And they would go over to Europe and question people in the 18th century. You know, you speak about freedom and you're not experiencing freedom any which way, because you're only free under the bondage of your monarch. And we don't have that in our lands, right? And we worked and strived to be in this proper relationship with the natural world, because the natural world is regenerative and it's diverse and it changes. It's not static. So it's a whole other way of viewing life as a human being. The Haudenosaunee encountered the founding fathers or vice versa and advised them on how they could form a more perfect union, you know, not build an empire. So they conversed with founding fathers in Philadelphia. And it's written, there's all this whole record about how they recount the coming of their peacemaker at Onondaga Lake, which is the area territory where we live. It's Onondaga Nation territory. And a peacemaker arrived and restored peace to five warring nations, many thousands of years ago. And in doing this, what he did was showed a way. He was a messenger of the creator. So he arrived, and he first thing he did was encounter a woman who had a big heart, and he instructed her how to select 50 women, take them into the forest, and if they followed protocol, there would be individual animals that would present themselves to each woman, and that would be the identifier of their clan. So it's not that humans say we're going to have a clan, let's do this. No, it's an interaction with the natural world, observation and respect and reciprocity with that being. So from the woman laid the groundwork of the clan system, which would connect every human being that was born to their place in the natural world. And then he encountered a very sad Hiawatha who'd lost his children to war, and his grief was inconsolable. He lost his voice, his hearing, everything. And the peacemaker, through the use of wampum beads, which are shell beads from the Quahog clan, he was able to console Hiawatha and clear his mind and his ears and his sight, so he could become whole again and be free to speak. And then together, they went around, brought the other nations together, and then they convinced the Tadadao, who was the most vile sorcerer anyone had ever come across before. And it was through their unity in demonstrating their acceptance of the peace, they were able to transform Tadadao. So all these titles from thousands of years ago still were in play when the founding fathers came into Haudenosaunee territory. So they influenced very much what became Western democracy in the world today. And of course, you know, the women's rights movement would come from this, Western democracy, lacrosse came from it, regenerative agricultural life ways came from it. Because when you're living in a proper relationship, those naturally follow, you know? Mm-hmm. So their influence has been and continues to be immense. And we still have the Anandaga are very much involved with the United Nations because they today still follow this structure. They never allowed a Bureau of Indian Affairs puppet regime or the regimes that were supplanted in Canada into Native territories. They retain their original status that existed before colonization. And today they're a very small community, but they're the freest nation on the planet. They have no prisons, no police. The FBI or the state police will not step foot on their territory unless they have permission.
Wow.
And they travel on their own passports around the world.
So
that's amazing. That is mind-blowing.
It is. Yes.
Yes. Very small group, very small nation. And they insist on being called a nation, mm-hmm. right? Where a lot of Native American nations refer to themselves as tribes, particularly out west. But they say that they fought hard for that sovereign nation status. And so they've stuck to that, you know. And I mean, I'm not surprised you hadn't heard about this because, you know, most Americans, most people in the United States have not heard about this either. That's one of the reasons why we developed the Scano Center, because, you know, it's something that people just don't know about. And the influence. So why don't we know about it? Probably because, you know, you, as Orrin Lyons likes to say, you can't take land from the good guys, right? You can't, you know, if you're in a relationship with Native people that goes back hundreds of years and you still want to diminish them as uncivilized or some other way in order to justify illegal land taking, and that's clearly the case. We live on unceded territory here in Syracuse, as many people do throughout the United States. Then, you know, that story of our essentially having been created through the Great Law of Peace that's thousands of years old here at Onondaga Lake does not match with that, you know, fiction of our superiority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely right. Can you talk a little bit about Scanon, the Great Law of Peace Center? And I think it came from, or previously had been St. Marie among the Iroquois. So please fill us in on that, because I was blown away when I visited Scanon. I just was moved to tears. It's so beautifully done and presented. So please tell our audience about that.
Okay, well, there's a lot to say. Again, another big topic, you know, but you know, and Sandy, you should probably tell that
story. Okay, when I was probably 5 years old, my dad took me to the French Fort, because that's what was originally there. It was just the structure commemorating when the Jesuits arrived here to Christianize the Onondaga. The truth of the matter is they arrived in 1656. They were coerced to get out of here 18 months later. It was a failed mission site, and never has there been to this day a Catholic church on Onondaga Nation territory.
Wow.
You know, they decided to build this fort in 1933 on the shore of Onondaga Lake, where our peacemaker came. And they built this fort, and it was built by the Onondaga Historical Association. It's called Onondaga because the county named itself after the Onondaga indigenous people who lived here. So they're butting heads, you know, they're not on the same river. And so they built this fort, but they built a 19th century fort instead of a 17th century fort, so they could promote the cowboy and Indian savage cowboy theme, right? And they sold tom-toms and feathered headdresses to children. So that's where my dad took me to see that fort. And he had me look out the window at Onondaga Lake and said, this is where they pointed their guns at us. And then I never went back, and always had this dark cloud whenever we go by this place. So by 1970, early 1970s, the Historical Association was embarrassed because it was inaccurate. You know, they were spreading propaganda about what happened. I guess I should mention in 1933, when they opened up that first fort, they had a reenactment with white actors. 33,000 people came for this event. They had airplanes flying overhead. It was broadcast on the local radio stations, and the actors portrayed Hiawatha coming across the lake in a white stone canoe. And it was our peacemaker, not Hiawatha. So that was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then he ascended these four steps they built to greet Father Lemoyne and gladly, with outstretched arms, accept Christianity in exchange for giving the Jesuits 600 square miles of land. And then everybody cheered.
That is repugnant.
It is. So,
but that's an actual document that was issued in 1650s to the Jesuits when they first arrived.
The deed.
It was an actual document. And that is an example of the doctrine of Islam, mm-hmm. essentially from the 17th century, right? So, yeah.
So anyway, that's important. Yeah. So, and they just excavated those steps like a couple months ago. And they were a prop. They're not even historical from the 17th century. And I don't know what the county or city is planning to do with those steps, but we have to keep an eye on them all the time for this resistance. So they built the new fort in early 1970s. And then they built this building. This is where you went for the repurposing. But when they built it, it was called St. Marie Among the Iroquois. And they hired urban Mohawk women who were members of St. Lucie's Catholic Church to work there. And it was at the time when they were all excited about canonizing Lidley into sainthood. So they were so happy, and they were working the Jesuits, excited to get this thing going on. And Phil and I, that was when Phil and I moved back to Syracuse. We had left for several years. And I went there in the morning because they were advertising an Easter service being held for the public in the fort. And I'm going, what's going on? Mm-hmm. This is on Dog and Nation territory. What are you doing? And so the new director said, oh, you need to meet my native employees here. So I said, okay. And that's when I found out they were all urban Catholic Mohawks. And so I said, this is on Dog and Nation territory, and you need to go tell your story out east, And within several years, the place almost went bankrupt.
Yeah.
And then OHA had an employee who said, oh my goodness, we can't let these martyrs die in vain. We have to keep this fort and this narrative alive, to honor our Jesuit martyrs, right?
Wow.
So Phil wrote a letter to the paper and said, I think there is a more important story that needs to be told here. And that's the story of the great law of peace. And oddly enough, here we are.
Right. So, yeah, so there were so many things wrong with the St. Marie Among the Iroquois. I mean, it was this celebration of this great friendship between the Onondaga and the Jesuits. But we know that's not true, because there's also, even though that was published in the Jesuit Relations, their accounts of what went on in their exploits in America, we have a wampum belt. Sandy was talking about wampum. Well, it's really, so there were belts created, at the founding of the Great Law of Peace here at Onondaga Lake. There are also wampum belts that are essentially treaties between different groups of people. And this wampum belt, called the Remembrance Belt, depicts a Jesuit priest with a black bead for his black heart. That then is connected to a cross that goes up to Montreal, which is where they were based. And essentially, they were amassing weapons at their fort to take control of the Confederacy, to attack the heart of the Confederacy and destroy the Haudenosaunee. And when they got wind of that, as Warren tells it, they went to that Jesuit priest and they cut off his little finger and said, if you do not leave, we're going to do worse than that.
Mm-hmm.
And they left in the middle of the night and escaped back to Montreal, and never to be seen again. So it was a failed mission. First of all, it was the Jesuits that named them as Iroquois, which is a name that is stuck. So their name for themselves are Haudenosaunee, people building a longhouse. Iroquois is a negative name, a pejorative name that was assigned to them, kind of a French version of an Algonquin word that's not very nice, put it that way. And
I had to have to interject with that story about the weapons stored in the fort. They actually hid them under the altar. And it was a little French boy who informed the Haudenosaunee because he loved them, you know, and he's the one who warned them these weapons were under the altar.
Right. Wow. So there's a whole other account.
So we need to refine that exhibit.
Yeah.
Right?
A whole other account of what went on then, which is does not appear anywhere, mm-mm, you know. And so when they were talking about this, the St. Marie among the Iroquois was a fictional account that comes from the Jesuits, who were just writing propaganda to really, you know, promote their own enterprises here in the New World. Get more funding from the French king and all that sort of thing. And so, but we have these other, what they call oral versions, but these are encoded in wampum belts, in stories that are passed down over generations. And really, it has to do with the survival of the Haudenosaunee.
And the wampum belts are not woven according to facts. They're really woven according to like true, what's true and has value in someone's life. That's why they recall that little boy connecting with them in the beads. The beads are connected to this sense of value and condolence. Like I said, the peacemaker used wampum to condole Hiawatha from his grief. So those beads are used in treaty belts because there's always this underlying theme that if you don't honor your words, you're going to return to grief. So you have to live a valued life and hold true to that.
Right.
So it's a different orientation to recording history. It's something that changes and is alive and has value today.
And if you would ask about the Scano Center, so
yeah,
well, we'd like to, you know, so we transition into that history. And, you know, as Tadadaho Sid Hill said, that this was going to be at least in part their Holocaust memorial, right? So, but if you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., for example, you don't learn very much about Judaism, which is something that we wanted people to know. We wanted people to know the values of the Haudenosaunee. So we took a values approach. Now, you know, I've been teaching indigenous religions for, you know, 30 years, and that's not the right term, though. I mean, it goes to your podcast audience. You know, religion is not really what we're talking about, because on the one hand, religion was used as a weapon against the indigenous peoples, and also they don't really have an area of their life that can be, you know, like separate from the world that would be articulated as religion. Like, that's religion over there. No, it's really a system of values, way of living in the world that we wanted to communicate. And so in my book, my new book, it's called The Urgency of Indigenous Values, I go through why religion kind of doesn't work. When we're talking about indigenous peoples, we're really talking about a value change, or a value change for survival. We need to move towards a different set of values in this world. And so So we use that approach, the values approach, at the Scano Center, not a historical approach, not an anthropological approach, but something that, and this is something that Sandy and I have learned works in a collaborative environment. You know, we can talk about cross-culturally about what kinds of values we want to impart and how to articulate those values very specifically, like knowing being in proper relationship to the natural world. So we start with Scano, and Scano, so the Onondaga, when they welcome or when they acknowledge one another, they say, Nyoen Haskano. That means thank you for being well. But it has in there, Scano, this idea of peace. And that peace can only be accomplished if human beings are in proper relationship to the natural world. We can't have peace with one another if we don't have peace with the natural world. All right. So that idea of Scano goes all the way through. That value of Scano goes all the way through the Scano Center, right? So, you know, when you're in proper relationship to the natural world, you have health, you have healing, you know, you have a proper mindset, right? A good mind. And so this process, this really a protocol, is at the center of Haudenosaunee political and spiritual, even economic thought, right? They think in terms of Scano. And that's what we wanted to emphasize. And then we learn, you learn about the Thanksgiving address, this ancient protocol that they recite before every meeting, literally every day. It can be a personal kind of affirmation. It can also be a public event. Sid comes up to Syracuse University at graduation and gives a 5-minute version. There can be a 2-hour version of this, of the Thanksgiving address. It's an oral recitation that acknowledges the different spiritual beings in the world: water, plants, animals, stars, planets, etc., people that have contributed to human life. And it's not a prayer, it's an acknowledgement, a thanksgiving. And so it ends with, each segment ends with, and now our minds are one. So it's a way of bringing consensus to a gathering.
Wow. And in doing this, there's no hierarchy. I mean, it's about attaining this good mind. And you can't have the mindset that you're going to turn everything over to God, or you have to be interactive in the world, because this is the creator is in all things. It's not the same as a God, completely a different framework. And so everything, the ceremonies, everything is oriented to this attainment of a good mind in being in proper relationship.
So, you know, again, you know, it might sound like religion, but it's really not. It's just a set of values. And then we talk about the creation narrative, you know, the creation story of Sky Woman descending onto the back of Turtle, and which then becomes Turtle Island.
Right. Sky Woman is falling and she's pregnant. And as she is falling through the sky towards water, because the entire earth is encapsulated in water, the sea creatures and sky creatures recognize that she's coming, that she's pregnant, and that she's got, you know, herbs like grasped in her hand, seeds. So they scamper about to prepare a place for her. So again, you know, it's the natural world reaching out to do something, you know, for the perpetuation of a human life. So Muskrat puts mud on Turtle's back after Turtle says, you can, you know, build this on my back. And Muskrat, in his last breath, because he dove so deep into the waters, his last breath, he slaps that mud on Turtle's back. When Sky Woman is set down gently, encased in the wings of the birds. She very first act she performs is one of gratitude that they have all done this for her. And she begins to dance counterclockwise on the little pad of mud. And as she's dancing in gratitude, the mud expands. It covers Turtle, eventually becomes Turtle Island. So the very first action is of gratitude. You're always going back to that interaction of life and being grateful for something, right, not some ascension from life here on Earth, but the integration of life.
Right. It's a totally different way of viewing things. It's absolutely different from the idea that the Earth belongs to man and man must subdue and conquer the Earth. It's like shockingly different. And now we see what's going on in North America and around the world as the world becomes profoundly sick, the world itself, because of greed, rather than working with the Earth and being thankful. It seems like if we would have just continued on the way that the Haudenosaunee were doing things, we wouldn't probably be in this mess that we're in right now.
It's so different.
Right. And given that, you know, we borrowed, you know, democratic principles, or were inspired by the Haudenosaunee for democratic principles, why don't we finish the job and you know, think more about their relationship to the natural world? That value system, I think, has to be part of our economic.
It's the urgency of that value system. Haudenosaunee do not really see themselves as stewards of the land, because you can't know as a human being what the land needs. So it's this interaction thing. Maybe it's more correct to say,
more like the land is the steward of us. Right.
Oh, wow.
That we're really dependent on the whole world around us. And so we have this fiction that human beings are in charge, but we're not. We're absolutely not. And, you know, I mean, scientific knowledge will just tell you that, or living through COVID will tell you that. You know, we're completely dependent on the world around us. And the only really proper attitude is one of thanks, one of thanksgiving. And, you know, it's not a technique for, you know, gaining mental health or anything like that. It's a way of living, living in the world. So, yeah.
We talk about recording time in the history books. You know, it's so static and unreliable. It's indefinite. But the Wampum Belts is another way of recording history. The natural world is yet another way of recording history. I mean, you look at the sky and reading stars, and it foresees the cycles of the earth. There are some plants, little weeds that blossom when a certain species of fish, you know, come into the stream. And it's another way of cueing in with time and rhythm and harmony and, you know, balance. Mm-hmm. Very different orientation. And all that was wiped out in so few years.
Yeah, the thing that wiped it out, though, was a different religious point of view. Okay, so it's not just that, you know, human beings are naturally greedy or this kind of thing, right? I don't think so. I don't think we're naturally greedy at all. I think we're naturally predisposed to being generous and thankful for the world around us, as indigenous peoples are. We were all indigenous at some point, right? But it's the imposition of a worldview that sees our being here on Earth as a mistake. Right, that we need to get some other place to be saved, to essentially, we should not be here, and we should be yearning to get to another world, to heaven.
Right, this earth is not our home.
Exactly. But it is. That's all we've got, you know. And I think that you know, that many religious people, not just Christians, of course, you know, but Muslims and others, have really bought into this idea that we don't really belong here. But, you know, I think that's probably just, you know, objectively not true. You know, we belong here. And we do have a responsibility to be here.
Yeah.
And I think Christians and others are trying to reassess that kind of theological framework that has really destroyed the world. I mean, you know, you can see it, you know, in belching pickup trucks. They just belch like, you know, there's a certain kind of apocalypticism that is so ingrained in American religion. And I'm using this loosely, you know, but colonial colonizing ideas of religion that really want to use up the world. So for a vision of the second coming. And mm-hmm. this is what we're grappling with here now.
We go to wars over these conflicting theologies and ideologies. We've gotten away from just living in a proper relationship where you are, you know, sustaining your diets and trying to localize more, you know, and be at the center. You are at the center where you exist.
How can we expand? Get the message out to people who are totally unaware of all these things that you've been talking about, and about really the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, the values that have been a part of your life and tradition for thousands and thousands of years. It seems like the world would be such a better place if people would embrace these values, but I don't know. If you're a small nation, I don't know. Are people moving away? Like, are young people moving away? Is there any way that the nation could be repopulated? I mean, I know Phil is teaching at the university, and you guys are holding conferences and doing the podcast. What can we do? What else can we do?
Well,
Onondaga is strong. I mean, their children pretty much stay, you know, within.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, definitely. The ceremonies, it's very vibrant. They have, you know, cycles of ceremonies every month and all kinds of meetings, and clan mothers have much influence. That system is very alive and well and flourishing among Haudenosaunee traditional, you know, territories.
Yeah, I mean, it was disparaged, you know, up until the late 70s. You know, U.S. law really made all indigenous practices of their traditions illegal until 1978 in the American Indian Religious Freedom Act. From that date forward, there are now these explosions of courses in Native American indigenous religions in all, you know, all manner of interest in these traditions. And I think probably, you know, not just Native youth, but also settler colonial youth, you know, are really understanding that they need to get a kind of different sense of what it means to be human in order to have a future, you know. I think the urgency of our moment is really what's going to drive a different way of thinking about the future. Seven generation thinking, for example, you know, when they raise Poyani or men of the good mind into their positions and they're chosen by their clan mothers, when they're raised into that position, they are instructed to think in terms of the seven generations into the future. Not in terms of their own immediate gratification. If our politicians and business people or people who are leaders in our world, if they thought in terms of seven generations into the future, that would just instantly transform everything, you know? So I think we have a lot of lessons. So podcasts like this, the work you're doing, Janice, is just remarkable. So I think we need to get a different sense of, you know, what it means to be human, you know, and how. And so we need to keep talking and instructing people, writing, you know, and it's not really about us so much as it's about the message that we're trying to promote.
Can you tell a little bit more about the Indigenous Values Initiative?
Yeah. Well, you know, like I said, it's an outgrowth. It's an outgrowth of our focus on values, you know. So, but it has a different sort of origin story. But yeah.
Okay, when we got involved with repurposing the Scano Center, first of all, the property is owned by the county, Onondaga County,
okay.
And then the Onondaga Historical Association, who built that fort way back when, it was 200 years off the mark, they managed the site. So it was kind of amazing that they wanted to work with us and coming in to fashion a new, you know, kind of narrative.
Yeah.
Right from the get-go, the director they had at the time made it very clear that everyone agreed at the Historical Association, they were not going to change the use of the word Iroquois for Haudenosaunee. They wanted to stick with Iroquois because that was the Jesuit name, right? So right at the onset, our heads were kind of, you know, ready to butt, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a real, real challenge.
So I as founding director, I created a collaboration with the different, like, my university, Lemoyne, which is a Jesuit college, you know, other universities, SUNY schools, Syracuse University, or State University of New York schools, community college, Environmental Forestry College. So we had a group of academics that could get together and could work with the Onondaga Nation, essentially, to protect their story, their narrative, their version of things, in order to present that at the Scano Center. Because the county and the nation are at loggerheads about practically everything, as you've experienced, I'm sure, in, you know, Canada. And so, and particularly about cleaning up Onondaga Lake, which is the most chemically polluted lake in the country. It's also a sacred place for the Onondaga because of this legacy. So in order for that to work, we had to have a broad kind of coalition, collaboration that would meet with and be guided by the Onondaga Nation. And we always had a kind of challenge with the county and OHA.
Mm-hmm.
Onondaga Historical Association. So there are a lot of Onondagas here we're talking about, but they're not the same kind of thing.
They don't represent the nation.
And so we learned very early on that we had to work with Onondaga Historical Association because they're managing the site. They're also going out and getting grants to create the site, but we never understood where the money was going, and they would kind of keep that from us. So we decided we had to create a 501c3, you know, nonprofit. That is Sandy and me. We now have board members of Citizens of the Onondaga Nation that are sit on our board. And so we're directed by the Onondaga and the Haudenosaunee. But we're a check on the power and influence of the county and OHA. So we have to keep kind of checks and balances in place,
and
certain kind of leverage to make sure that we're, you know, keeping on message, you know, at the Scano Center, because they're interested in turning into a tourist site or something like that. We want to kind of challenge people. We see it more as an educational site and something that will challenge people a bit, not make them uncomfortable, but, you know, rather just get them thinking, you know, like we do in classes.
I have to interject, though. The original director left a year or so ago. It got very hideous. and we have a new director. And she's a woman. And it's quite a turnaround.
Yeah.
You know,
it's really different now.
She still has a lot to learn, but she's learning. You know,
and interesting,
making a real effort. So
yeah, I mean, things are improving, but it's been over 10 years now that we've been open, and it's been a real challenge all the way along. I like to say, if you want to, you know, lose sleep for the rest of your life, open a peace center.
Yeah, well, I definitely found it incredibly educational. I would have liked to have spent more than just a few hours there. I feel like I could have spent a few days really taking in and reading and looking at all the artifacts that are there. It just was, I'm really glad I got to experience it. And I'm so grateful to you both for the conference that you hosted in December at the university. That was tremendous. I don't know if you're ever going to do it again, but boy, I sure would love to come back and attend and participate again. And I'm very happy to continue spreading the word about the work that you're doing. How can people find you? Do you have, like, is there a direction? Is there any place on the internet that they should be going? And you can also send me any links and I'll include them in the show notes.
Oh, yeah, sure. So our links are indigenousvalues.org. That's our website. Also, we've created a website for the Doctrine of Discovery, doctrineofdiscovery.org. And you'll find there are translations of these papal bulls, and probably we're going to be publishing a lot of the papers that were presented at the conference. And we've been having these conferences for, again, over 10 years. And we're definitely going to have more in the future, because it was supported by the Henry Luce Foundation. And I mean, I think that, you know, you wouldn't have found that kind of support 5 years ago for this kind of work. And I think that more and more these foundations are funding, more critical assessment of religion and, you know, where it is right now. So I think, we'll definitely send you the links, and really appreciate you, Janice, for coming out. And and if you come out again, or any of your listeners want to visit Syracuse in the Scano Center, you can let us know and we'll give you a tour.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Thank you again. It was just delightful to see you, and I'd like to keep in touch with you both.
Please do. Yes, absolutely. Connection is the name of the game here.
Yes. Thank you again. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in today. And I hope to see you again soon. Take care, everyone. Thank you.